Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. Thanks for joining me wherever you are. My guest this week is Mavuso Msimang, an ANC veteran who lived in exile for many decades and is an outspoken critic of the former president, Jacob Zuma. He comes from a long line of ANC stalwarts and counts Richard and Selby Msimang as his great uncles. It was interesting, I suppose, and by chance that we were meeting on the second day of the former president's testimony, if one can call it that, at the Zondo Commission of Inquiry. So the discussion was couched in the context of that, although we didn't go into too much detail of the testimony itself. Mavuso went for military training in Moscow in 1962 and worked then in the ANC underground in exile until his family returned to South Africa in 1993. I'm an historian by training and particularly interested in military history, so we did spend quite a bit of time in the discussion just talking about some of the practicalities and logistical challenges of starting a guerrilla movement from scratch, and you know just the difficulties of infiltrating people back into the country during the war for liberation, and just also just living under that sort of threat of attack and death for so many years. And he was a personal friend of Chris Hani, who was eventually assassinated. And we just talk about that from a very his personal reaction to that event and also the impact on the ANC and the country at the time. We also chatted about the current state of the ANC, about what he sees as the moral and ethical decline of the ANC, and South Africa's prospects for the future. So please now enjoy my chat with Mavuso. Mavuso, thanks so much for your time this morning. I really appreciate it. From your recent phone calls, I can understand you're a busy man, so I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
You were one of the... I want to go into a little bit of your history. You're an ANC stalwart, an MK veteran. And I want to maybe just get a sense of where you were when you made the decision to leave the country. Would it have been in the early 1960s? How old were you when you left South Africa?
I left South Africa at the age of 21. I was at Fort Hare University then. Perhaps just to take it a few years back.
Sure.
I went to high school at Inkamana High School in Vryheid, Northern
KwaZulu-Natal
now. Yes, yeah. That's right. In a Catholic school. 1958 was a year of very serious debates. That was about 2 years after the, was it 3 years after the Freedom Charter.
Yeah.
The Pan-Africanist Congress had just broken off in 1958.
Right.
Disagreeing very, very violently, viscerally with the adoption of the Freedom Charter by the ANC, because they thought this was giving away the land, the heritage to white people. So I get into ANC politics in 1958 at school, and the debates were just amazing.
In the Catholic school environment?
Yes, absolutely. But okay. We would just sit and talk. It wasn't necessarily sanctioned, but it wasn't prohibited either. We did it in the hostels, and there were PAC, there were ANC people. And
That was the main divide then?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And I mentioned this because the PAC had some really appealing slogans, you know, Izwele to our land, where we would be saying South Africa belongs to all of us, including the very white people who in the majority were suppressing us. But really, one was exposed to some people who really had Marxist backgrounds, and the class analysis of the situation was very predominant in our thinking already. And it was really very easy, as happened with quite a number of young people, to flow into the PAC. And but at that point, I really began to understand that the struggle, even though we were oppressed by white people without any doubt, that the struggle was about class, it was a social issue. It was about those who have and those who have not. It was about the management of resources, who manages resources, and so on. I went to Fort Hay in 1962 to do what was called pharmacy. I really had no intention of doing pharmacy, but Fort Hay at the time had been reclassified. The Bantu education system had rolled in. And I come from the Zulu heritage, and I should not have been allowed to go to Fort Hare otherwise. I should have gone to the University of Zululand, which was called Ongoye, and not want those things at all.
Mpangeni.
Yes. You just did not want tribal universities.
So that's how the universities were structured in those days. That never crossed my mind, actually.
Yes.
I knew they were sort of bound to education, of course. But, okay, so it was the Tswanas must go, I suppose, to Turfloop or...
Absolutely, absolutely.
Huh. So you were rebelling us in sort of small way. You were rebelling by going to a Xhosa university in that context.
In fact, it wasn't a Xhosa university. They were about to designate it as a Xhosa university. Fort Hare had traditionally been a black university.
Yes, very old tradition of education.
Leadership from Southern Africa, you know, the Mugabes, whatever
exactly,
we think of
from
him
all
today.
All countries in Southern Africa sent people there.
So we went in there because Fort Hare had that reputation.
Sure.
But as we got there, Kaiser Matanzima, the first chancellor of the Transkei, president of the Transkei, so-called.
The homeland.
Had been made a chancellor of the University of Fort Hare.
Already?
Yes, they made him around that time.
Would he have been?
Well, he was, would have been in his 40s.
Okay.
Yes.
My goodness.
So I come into Fort Hare fairly highly politicized. The ANC has been banned. We fit into what was called the M-Plan. It's a structure where you formed cells of five people and you're not supposed to know four of you.
Yes, exactly.
And so
very
on.
Separate, separated.
So I was in the high command of that structure, even
so
though
already
fresher. Yeah,
my
that's
goodness.
Right.
You obviously got, you were connected into the ANC at a very young age. Was that through your family background?
I say that my family, Richard Msimang, wrote, or at least headed up the group that wrote the constitution of the ANC.
Okay.
Now, Richard Msimang would be my grand uncle. Selby Msimang.
Oh, I know that name. I haven't drawn that connection. Okay.
Richard was the older brother to Selby.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, so you come from deep ANC stock.
ANC roots. So we organize a boycott of the visit, of the planned visit by Matanzima as chancellor of the university.
Okay.
And we are saying, no way are we going to allow Fort Hare to be tribalized. This is
part of the puppet
university.
Structures.
Exactly.
Right.
And the boycott of his visit was very effective, so effective that I don't think more than 8 people, fewer than 10, quite a few of them from Matanzima's family, attended the meeting. And then we knew, of course, that the bad thing would hit the fan very soon.
Yeah.
And we went immediately underground apprehensive of arrest by the police. So the leadership of the ANC in the region, which was in they operated out of Port Elizabeth,
okay,
instructed those of us who had been identified as ringleaders to prepare to leave the country and pursue our studies overseas.
Mm.
Cuba was the most popular country at the time.
Wow.
And we were all singing,
okay,
take the country, the Cuba, the Castro way, you know, I mean.
Yeah. That was okay, that was the inspiration, yeah.
So we left, really cutting what would be a long story short. And we on the very morning we left, hours, the police came to raid the hostels.
Man.
And boarded the train, took the train, not at the nearest station, but one further than that, Cookhouse, I think.
Cookhouse, my goodness. Okay, I've driven past Cookhouse.
So we're off to
Park Station, right.
Where, on arrival, as we disembarked, there was a phalanx of police waiting. I think it was just routine.
Waited
for anybody coming to the Witwatersrand.
Mm-hmm.
And they would just
checking passes.
Yeah, that's right. I was lucky. I was with five other people that they did not ask me to produce my dompas. So I passed, and that's how I got into this place.
My goodness.
I mean, if they caught me, I would have been sent back immediately, either to Fort Hare or to Pietermaritzburg. My home is in Pietermaritzburg, because you needed permission to be there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we got to Soweto to a safe house and stayed there while the ANC arranged
a passage
to Botswana and onwards.
Hmm.
Yeah.
One of the things you were taking refuge in these frontline states, and I want to sort of look at it in quite a broad sort of time frame here, from the time you went into exile and the time the ANC controversies were operated in a lot of these frontline countries, Botswana, Zambia, Tanzania, Swaziland. They were always seen as countries that supported the struggle against apartheid, but it was quite a tricky relationship, it seems to me, that you were never really...
safe.
Quite comfortable.
Oh, yeah. Well, in my case, this is 19...
Even from the local authorities, I'm not even talking about the South African security services, but from the Botswana police or the... you know, there always seems to be tension.
It's been the case right through. You must recognize that South Africa was always the strongest power in the subcontinent, militarily, possibly also in the continent.
Economically as well.
Economically, definitely. I don't know about Egypt and South Africa at the time, but certainly it was the powerhouse of Africa. So neighbors tended to be very, very wary about offending by keeping people who were not desirable to the South Africans.
Mm.
But right now, we are talking about 1963 when Botswana was still Bechuanaland. It was before
it got
its independence.
It was colonial, it was a protectorate or whatever, a colony still.
It was still a protectorate, yes. But just a little bit about Botswana. When I eventually we got to Botswana, we were given a place in Francistown, a place just called the White House, where you had refugees coming from all around the countries, troubled countries like Namibia, Zimbabwe, mainly, and South Africa. But just then, on June 11th, 1963, they busted the leadership of the ANC in Rivonia.
Right.
We were waiting in Francistown to take a plane that would take us north, to get onto a plane that would take us north to Tanzania or wherever we're going to go. So it was at that point that I decided that there was no way I would go to school. I would just have to go to another kind of school where I would learn how to fight.
Military school.
Absolutely.
Huh.
I mean, the arrest of Sisulu, Mbeki, and all the leaders, as we all know now. Mandela was already arrested. was devastating. And we just thought, no, there's no way. So the ANC fortunately agreed. And when the plane eventually came, the first one to arrive, a charter plane, charter flight, the South African Special Branch bombed it on the ground.
Wow.
Just on the eve of our departure. So
it blew it up.
Absolutely, they blew it up.
Wow.
Because they were trying to stop who had one of the, I think it was Charles Ezra, who was the owner, so-called, of Rivonia. And
of the farm.
Of the farm.
Okay, yes, the guys who escaped from prison.
That's right.
Yes.
Those two, they had crossed to Swaziland, and they were taken a little flight and overflew South Africa to Botswana, and they were under the protection of the British High Commission, or whatever it was called, in Botswana. So they knew, the South African government knew that they were going to take this plane, and they wanted to explode it and so on.
Unreal. But so you knew you were in a war. I mean, you knew you were in a deadly fight then very early on.
It was very clear. ANC is banned. The leadership has decided that we are not going to allow ourselves as an organization to be killed. So as Mandela said, you either give in or you continue to fight. And the continuation of the fight was only going to be through armed struggle.
Hmm.
So we knew we were already in that phase.
At the same time, you're in a fight. You're one of the senior commanders now of a very young guerrilla organization, and facing all those. I mean, I can't even really imagine. You're kind of starting from scratch, just to. Not only even plan operations, but just plan what you want to achieve and how you're going to achieve it.
It's nice to be young because there is a fair bit of adventure, I must admit. I mean, we were determined that we're going to fight and liberate our country. How we're going to do that, we would figure out as we went along. There would be a leadership and so on.
And as you're going along, of course, hooker by crook also means people die, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the early stages, very few people died. It took time to engage the enemy.
Mm.
I mean, you talked about the frontline states and the states that actually gave the liberation movements, because there were five of them at the time. It was the ANC, Frelimo,
MPLA.
MPLA. ZAPU, ZANU.
Right.
And,
yes, we forget the whole subcontinent was fighting for freedom at the time.
Absolutely, yes. So it always was a very dicey thing. While in terms of the OAU resolutions, frontline states agreed.
Committed
to supporting freedom fighters, liberation fighters. The reality on the ground was that our presence in these countries was very restricted, and one understood it. I mean, you could not introduce weapons of war. In fact, in the early days, when we got into, I'm happy I can say this now, when we were coming back from Tanzania, heading south, we didn't go through the official border post in Zambia, Tanzania, Zambia, because you just did not want to take a chance. The British army was still there in charge, you know. Mind you, this is, for me, this is 1965, and Zambia had become only free in 1964, in October. So you're still at the head of the a British person heading up the army, and the police also, I think, were under control by the former colonial powers. So yes, it was always a difficult thing.
Your first, as far as I understand it, then the first engagements did take place then in Rhodesia, combined operations with ZANU, was it?
No, it was with ZAPU.
ZAPU, I get that confused. Yes, okay. And that was also, I mean, that seemed to also then cause some tension amongst some of the MK people that felt, and I mean, I've heard this before as well, that, you know, people wanted to go do their training, whether it was in Angola or wherever it was, and go and fight in South Africa for the South African freedom struggle, not to fight somebody else's battle. Yes. Was that the case? I mean, was there a happy coexistence of cooperation?
There was a fair bit of that, but perhaps to bring the context of how we got involved in Zimbabwe, we'd come back, most of the people had finished their training in different countries, Egypt, Algeria, Morocco.
Where did you go for your training?
I went to Moscow.
Oh, wow.
Where they, I spent a year, 11 months, 2 weeks, training in urban guerrilla warfare. And we were... Our group consisted of people who all had a fair bit of education, at least, so that we could understand the handling of explosives, homemade, be able to navigate through the use of topography, etc., etc. So we got training that assumed correctly that we would be going back into a South Africa where there would be no easy access to weapons, where you would have to make your own explosives. So we were taught how to make that. Mm. We were taught politics, of course, which had been Marxism. We were taught shooting every gun that exists on Earth, from a revolver, pistol, submachine gun, everything.
So very intensive training then.
It was very
radio,
very
radio operations.
I specialized
surveillance,
in radio.
Counter surveillance.
Yeah. There were four.
Yes, I see you were the communications officer for that Lutuli detachment, or for the early Wanki.
Yes. Well, I was the communications person, but in this group that trained in Moscow, there were 23 of us. Four of us stayed behind a little bit to learn radio communication,
right.
The Morse code, you know?
Yeah.
To be able to transmit messages from a long range and so on, high frequency communication.
Yeah.
Of course, you have to code
sort of burst,
your messages.
Burst messaging.
But you've got to code it, because anybody who is listening, and it's easy to pick up these signals, would know A is the da, B, and so on. Mm. So you need to not just say A, B, I'm sitting with Claude. You have to code that and so on.
I've read in other books about, because I'm quite interested in that sort of spy craft and that. It's like you could almost tell a person by the way they used their Morse code.
Oh, yes.
Just by the way they hit their dots and dashes.
You could tell who's communicating.
Oh, that's Mavusa.
Yeah. No. At least among the group that communicates together, you
that's
knew
incredible.
Who was there. Yeah.
Did you get quite good at that?
Oh, you had to, yes.
You had to be.
Yeah.
The fascinating thing for me is, at the same time as you're doing all this training and you going on actions, you studying as well, and you raise a family.
Yeah.
Was that a deliberate effort to sort of get some normality into your existence, or did that sort of just happen?
It just happened, and it was a very difficult decision for me to request to go back to school. You will recall that I just said that when I got to Francistown and the leadership was arrested, I just thought, wait, the school can come a little later.
Yeah.
So we were involved, as I was trying to explain. We trained, and when we finished our training from various countries, we went. Were given what was called a transit camp in Tanzania. We all naively, I can say today, believed that we wouldn't be there for more than 6 months, at most 1 year, and we would be back in South Africa fighting and so on, or at least doing some underground work.
There was that sense of energy and commitment.
Oh, absolutely, and morale was very high, and You're talking about 400, 500 people who
had changed. And as you say, young people.
Very. But coming back proved to be a lot more difficult than going out. And frustration started building up when a year turned to two and into 3 years. So this operation that we were talking about, which led us to cooperating with the Zimbabweans, was based on a number of things. It was a reaction to the pressure. It was our own people.
Was to get the guys doing something.
Yes, and also some of them were losing morale and leaving camp and wanting to go to study or become refugees. The OAU, that's what it was called at the time, was saying, guys, when do you start fighting? It's 1966 now, and you've been in the camps since 1964, etc. So there was a pressure, although anybody who understood the geopolitics of the area would have known that there was no way in which the South African struggle would have been carried out like the Mozambican one. For instance, Frelimo got to the neighboring province south of Tanzania, Cabo Delgado, and there would be all there was, and I'm not denigrating, downplaying the struggle, but in terms of the opposition, there would have been a fort or some little place.
Outpost.
Outpost, that's what I'm looking for, where there would be Portuguese platoon or whatever the number, and not much in settlements. And so they were able to capture province by province, and they got to Tete and so on, and they were moving south, something, of course, you would never dream of doing in South Africa, given its high level of sophisticated infrastructure, communication, road, air, and everything. Yeah,
and so, the military, proper military security structure as well.
Absolutely. And the fact that to get to South Africa, you had to traverse about three countries. Zambia, for starters, you'd either go in through Rhodesia, which was under Ian Smith at the time, and so on. So it wasn't that easy. So our belief that we're going to be back in South Africa fighting in 6 months and so on was just really
quite naive,
based on naivety. But the pressure mounted, and in 1967 we found ourselves negotiating with Zimbabweans. ZAPU was the major party at the time. And they were closest to, most conveniently located on the route to South Africa, you know, the western part of Zimbabwe. Anyway, that's really what happened. We had what came to be called Wonky, the operation,
yes.
And the following year, Sipolilo. I think Simpson.
Yes,
writes
I've been reading
that,
Tula Simpson's Mkhonto we Sizwe. I just sort of read that chapter a little bit because I knew of your involvement in that campaign, and so I'm not by no means an expert, but I was actually struck by the violence of that campaign.
Yes.
How many people died on both sides? Actually, I mean, it's often, I think, when we grew up, obviously in our white education system, that was seen as a failure on many levels by the ANC, and I think there were obviously some concerns raised that area of operations did become very much very dangerous for any guerrilla activities. But I mean, there were battles, there were actual contacts, and day long, week long.
We can talk about those engagements on another day because it's a subject on its own. But suffice to say that this Wonky operation that is much talked about, the too many people from our side, just too many people, entered. And again, I think, may they forgive me for saying this, my leaders, a consequence of desperation to get people out. But the important thing is that the people who were in that contingent, they were so highly motivated. Chris
Hani was there, yes, I saw that. And Jonathan Moyo from the ZAPU side,
no,
right?
No.
Oh, was that? Okay.
No, wasn't. But there were three engagements. If anybody tells you about Wonky, there were three. all of them, in all of them, our guys were ambushed. Mm. And in all of them, our guys killed the enemy.
Prevailed.
The first one, I think it was Captain Smith, who came up, stood by the hill. This is an account, I wasn't there. But he was taken down. His deputy, Timitia, who were the leaders of the Rhodesian African Rifles, both of them were killed. Huh. I mean, you cannot possibly say you killed the leadership of a unit and say the guerrillas were beaten and so on. But, I mean, but let's talk about that on another day.
Yeah,
so.
Sure.
But no, you were asking me about raising a family and all of that. It was really after 1969-70 when there was a bit of a lull. Things were really difficult in the country. Mm. People were underground or they were in exile or they had gone to prisons, different places, including Robben Island. And really, one was not very active, and I asked for permission to resume my studies. Mm. And of course, the understanding always being that
when we're ready to go, you're going to be going. Yeah. I think in that context as well, as you say, the lull, you talk about a lull, but it's also then again the challenge of keeping up your morale and your belief that this struggle can still will continue and will be successful. How do you convince yourself of that at a time when, I mean, you know, even chatting to Ronnie Casuals, he was saying up until even perhaps the mid-70s, I mean, it was almost impossible to operate in South Africa as a significant military force. Sure. How do you maintain that belief?
You know, we were absolutely convinced that white rule would not live forever, would not last forever. And we were the agents of this change. We went into this thing fully understanding that it was going to be really difficult. One hoped it could be a little different, but we were aware that we're in for the long haul. Most of the people were. Some fell by the wayside. There are those who left, went to Kenya, and they were flown back into South Africa. There are others who asked to be given the opportunity to do other things, which was a positive thing. Mm. And the schools that were built for, especially after 1976, to take in
all the people Soweto that came, group,
that also helped. And I think more and more people were sent to for further studies. Most of the Soweto group, really, it was really a question of taking them at high school level and so on. Mm. So there were a number of mechanisms of coping and keeping things going.
Had the cultural groups then as well. That
cultural groups, diplomatic work.
Yes.
There was always something, but there was always an attempt to find a way in at all times, whether you were going to get a boat, take a boat in Somalia. And
I've read about that. There's a submarine thrown in there somewhere as well.
And all of those things. No,
yeah.
We were not very many. The good thing was that morale was really high. Mm. Conditions were difficult. I think until we got to the Angola situation, which I don't know very much about because that's the time when I had resumed my studies, the treatment of ANC people was always very civil, was very proper. We ate the same kind of food as the leaders. The treatment was good. It was just hard.
Mm.
But that's not to say
people
were all happy and so on. A lot of people ended up going for retraining.
Mm-hmm.
Others pursued studies.
Yeah.
And most, I don't know.
I suppose it is about as diverse a group as you would anticipate a group of people to be.
You talked about cultural groups. When we got to Kongwa in 1994, which is in Tanzania, this transit camp I talked about, we formed a club, and soccer club. And
you said 1994.
Sorry, 1964. I know, sorry, 64. And
Yeah.
And we competed with the Tanzanian clubs.
In the league.
Yeah, just,
oh, nice,
you know,
yeah.
And so
yeah, no good.
And
always so something to wave a flag
there
at.
Was always, oh, absolutely. Some we sang, yeah. There were choirs.
Yes.
Good choirs. Jonas Gwangwa, famous, actually came into the ANC and the MK and and had a group that toured the whole world singing the struggle, you know. Yeah. Taking the message of the struggle through music and through dance and so on.
The cultural propaganda kind of. Yeah.
There were those activities.
You mentioned Chris Harney. So I do have to know, I have written down here the death of Chris Harney because it struck me. I mean, I worked for the National Peace Accord down in Port Shepstone. I remember very clearly that day when I heard on the news of his assassination. And then a couple of weeks later, we had the funeral and the whole place exploded. Mm. But I just want to ask you on a sort of personal level, how devastating that was for the ANC as an organization, that that assassination, and for you personally having, fought with him.
Yes, Chris was actually a personal friend. We worked together in Zambia, and we would drive the same car. And do the work that needed to be done. So one was affected very, very directly by his killing. If we didn't have a good leader like Nelson Mandela, who calmed the waters, things would have really, there would have been a reversal of whatever gains there had been because people were angry. Mm. They wanted, many of them were really calling for a fight. You know, the negotiations.
Your comrades.
The comrades. Mm. A lot of the people had been a little skeptical about negotiations and thinking, aren't these guys doing a reverse of Dingaan, calling us in, and when we're inside
in
here,
the circle,
then they'll encircle us and kill you. There was always that skepticism. Mm. It was really a sad day in the life of the ANC. Chris was really admired by many. His colleagues, us, he was the best among us, I have to say.
Yeah.
Not without mistakes of his own, but the one thing you could not accuse him of is lacking the will to fight. He wasn't going to stay one day longer in exile. And so this Zimbabwe incursion, for instance, he walked the talk because it was a mission that wasn't going to succeed ultimately. People really highly motivated, skilled. It was clear that logistically, even if you beat everybody along the way, by the time you got to the Limpopo River,
not much
you
left.
You'd be left with nothing. But so that was Chris. He put his feet, what they say, where his mouth was. Mm. So no. His killing was really a shattering experience. And he remains a hero in his death.
Do you think that had a long-term impact on the ANC as an organization? If we assess the ANC today, I mean, it's difficult to sort of speculate.
Always difficult to speculate. Certainly, Chris would have been among the progressive groups who would have had perhaps more influence than others in stopping the deterioration and the corruption and that was to follow once the ANC, after the ANC had been in government. Chris had decided that he was not going to be in government. He had become a member.
He made that clear.
No, he made that quite clear. He despised the so-called, I think he wasn't fond of bureaucracy, and he thought he feared that power had the potential to corrupt people. Mm. And he already made comments in recorded interviews where he was saying people start becoming fascinated by nice cars, big houses, and really forgetting about the revolution which is meant II, which was always meant to take care of the interests of the poorest of the poor. Mm. So he did say that he wouldn't be a member of government, he would stay in the party and fight from there. What would have happened had he survived? I really don't know. I don't like to predict those things, but certainly he would have been on the side of progressive people, the non-corrupt, and perhaps the respect that he had earned from people might have arrested the situation a little bit, but I doubt. You know, once the corruption in this country happened because we failed to manage power. We didn't seem to understand that power needs to be managed by putting in place things that would say you may not do so and so. Absolutely.
I suppose, I mean, one of the problems is that the ANC inherited such a corrupt and morally bankrupt system in a sense that it was kind of, I don't know, I just sort of wonder about that.
Yes.
And then on top of that, the dilemma that we're seeing, I suppose, today, this sort of philosophical dilemma of the ANC, of what the purpose of the struggle was. Was it a social struggle or was it a nationalist struggle? Was it a struggle that was going to not only free people but make an equitable society, or was it a struggle that was going to create just another level of an elite, or give everyone a chance to become rich, I suppose? I don't know if I'm making
sense. You know, two quotations from O.R. might help answer some of the questions you're raising. He used to say very often when we sat O.R. Tambo that the purpose of the struggle is to defeat the system of apartheid and replace it with a democratic and ethical system of governance. Always would add ethical system of governance. He was just so conscious.
That was the lawyer conscious in him, I suppose.
That was now the humanist in him.
Mm.
He was one of the people who argued very strongly when the Constitution, in preparing for the Constitution, that there must be a Bill of Rights. So you're not going to victimize people because they belong to a certain group for the sins of their ancestors. Bill of Rights is part of the most important tenets of our Constitution. But also, Tambo used to say, why we are revolutionaries, that's what we claim to be. We have to have a revolutionary consciousness. We cannot be seen to be using the enemy standards as our as you can't use the enemy behavior as our standard. When people said, but you know, the apartheid regime, the nationalists were very corrupt and so on, we said, but who says they must be our standard? How can we measure ourselves against them? Because the whole purpose of the struggle is indeed to remove racism and set
to
up
rise above
a morally higher standard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was your feeling once the ANC was unbanned? Where were you when the ANC was unbanned?
I was in Addis Ababa with UNICEF.
Right, yeah.
But I had been doing all the time that I was not within the national offices. I had assignments which were easier to carry out because of where I was.
Right.
I had acquired important passports so I could go on missions to places where my passport held me in good stead. Of course, you still needed to be very careful because the enemy knew you were South African and not a Canadian or something like that.
Okay, Addis Ababa.
Addis Ababa,
a great day. I mean, what was your emotional state on that day?
No. When 1994, April 27 happened.
I'm talking about the unbanning, 1990.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was excitement, but there was caution. We just thought, gee whiz, these guys have not been defeated in the battlefield. So, yes, this is a huge step forward, but we need to proceed with caution. You still had people like Constant Feldjoun really talking war, and you had that other ridiculous person who drove
the AWB people into Botswana.
Yes, and so on. So the tensions were very high.
Sure.
A lot of people from the white population used to walk about the streets of Johannesburg here with guns.
Openly displayed. And there was the IFP thing as well.
IFP people was a really big issue too, which was assisted by the South African government. I mean,
they opened up
a training camp in Caprivi Street. The violence, so-called, what did they used to call it?
Black-on-black violence
was very much encouraged by the regime. There's no doubt about that. There's plenty of evidence. But one would be lying to say it excited us. It was great news. I mean, it was we were very excited.
But you accepted that as a sort of first phase then. Right, you knew that there was still work to be done.
Sure.
So what year did you then return to South Africa?
1993.
Okay.
1993 before 1994.
So you were here for the election.
Yes.
And you voted then.
Oh yes.
Where were you? Where was your voting station?
I was in Durban.
Okay, cool. Yes. I was in Port Shepstone actually.
Oh, yeah, no.
I was living down in Port Shepstone. I drove into the hills one afternoon. We were doing monitoring for those days, and I'll never quite forget the queues of people.
Yeah, that's what everybody talks about, absolutely. Yeah.
It was also a joyful occasion.
Yeah, so it was. It was a really exciting.
So there's so much then. I mean, then we have the euphoria, the sort of rainbow nation and Rugby World Cup, I suppose. I'll throw that in, Cup of Nations. I mean, all these things are happening. I mean, there's a real kind of sense of something new that we think can work. We have the Saint Mandela looking over us. What has happened now with the ANC? Because it seems almost like you say not handling power, but I mean it seems beyond. That's why I was sort of referring to the immorality of the apartheid regime. It seems that there's kind of no moral compass anymore. I mean, every day you read a news story about more money going somewhere for some apparent reason, billions and billions all the time. Any excuse to take money?
No, there are very many reasons to explain the sad decline in the ethical standards, in the governance, the rampant corruption that is taking place in South Africa today. I think it could be explained in many ways. One of the reasons this happened was that as the ANC started operating openly, it attracted a lot of people to its ranks who should not have been there. It became attractive after 1994, because it was clear that it was going to go into government, and coming into the ANC provided the opportunity for economic and other opportunities. We argued, maybe a little bit late, that there should have been more stringent conditions for acceptance into membership of the ANC. In the past, anybody wanted to go to join the ANC was serious because it was risky. You could be arrested, you could be killed, and so on. But this time, really, joining the ANC attracted just too many.
It's an easy option for people.
We did need to tighten up our electoral processes. Clearly, the people who are so corrupt today include many who were in the ANC already.
In exile. Or underground in the country.
But there is the influence of money, of material things just took over. You know, I theorize about these things when I see it, and I want to put this thing in writing and say, when the ANC took power, it didn't prepare an effective financing strategy for the organization. It was very clear that the ANC was going to have offices in all provinces, in all regions. And to do that, particularly when you're in government, was always going to open you to certain temptations of using
funding sources
that were not really quite. I believe, and we did talk about that, but of course,
hindsight is always 20/20.
But I think if we had looked for money, Mandela was the saint, as you said, loved by everybody on earth who had money in the West, politicians and so on. I mean, he was a good fundraiser. Perhaps the monies that were being raised should have been put into an endowment fund and the fund managed by professionals. Mm. And the ANC would indicate its budget, and the whole thing should have been managed. Because not having money actually has encouraged the corruption. So the BEE program, which was essential in my opinion, we had to get black people also into business, sure, and so on, but then gets abused so easily. That's how we create tenderpreneurs, because people go to get tenders from government, and government had a lot of these things to give, and somebody would be saying, you give me, I'll donate some of it to the organization.
And to you personally, I suppose.
Well, this is now outright corruption, but so people didn't really, it was subverted, and people colluded. Some of the money, I think, that was being won by these tenderpreneurs did get into the ANC. Mm. I'm a businessman, thanks to you, ANC, who's given us freedom. Here is my donation. But you didn't even know how much of the money you got in the contract went to the ANC. And how actually, I think a person who just came straight and didn't promise to give others money, a lot of the cadres being in government, you know, the bias was obvious. I mean, what happened subsequently clearly was a consequence of this thing. And I really still think that if the ANC had solid, not just money, but also good people and money, we talked about people coming into the ANC, into leadership in the ANC, and being very easily influenced by the need to have funds. You know, the revelations in the Zondo Commission, Bosasa paying bribes to people. Well, I think people are so soft. Some of the people are so soft on those who receive bribes, because some of the money would be passed to the organization. So you actually did not just have corrupt leaders, but also a corrupt organization. So you ask how we got here. I think these are some of the reasons.
I mean, I think for me, one of the main concerns is there doesn't seem to be, even within now the parliamentary ANC, a sort of significant sense of a rebirth or change or support for whatever Cyril Ramaphosa is trying to do. And I'm not even sure exactly what he is trying to do right now, what he's capable of. Of doing, okay, he's going to reform SARS and the NPA, and maybe that's sort of will be his legacy, I don't know. But that for me is, I think, the glaring sort of concern right now.
We deviated from what I would call the core mission of the ANC, which was really to uplift those at the bottom of the social ladder. I think in developing programs for the development programs, water provision, housing, sanitation, electricity, and all of those things should have been primary in the programming and allocated budgets accordingly. But also they should have been managed by people with integrity. So yes, indeed, a lot of houses were built, but how many of them were built by people
who didn't know how to build a house?
Who didn't know how to build a house. And so much money has been spent on housing that we always boast about, but it's been some of it to redo the houses that had been built and collapsed. Mm. And so you have a situation also where people just come in and allow people to, on the pretext of providing water and sanitation, potable water, people just take the money. The corruption really has happened because I think the ANC has been infiltrated or has changed leaders, many leaders, into corrupt people. You know, the example I used to make about not putting a strong code of ethics, code of conduct. The Chinese have these things. They tend to be quite severe about about punishing
offenders. Not sure that's where we want to go.
But there should be, even now, a sanction against this, a pretty heavy sanction, maybe a custodial sentence for people who commit some of these crimes. No, I don't think we should ever reintroduce capital punishment or do those kinds of things. But, I mean, since the Gupta leaks a few years ago, you haven't seen many people being arrested.
Mm. Or let alone people resigning.
Or people resigning. So these are the things, the ethics. I suppose you could have codes of behavior. If they are not enforced, then they're meaningless. Yeah. But I don't think we even had them. The drift has happened. It's almost, I always think that this corruption thing must happen in the life of a society that develops just like the wildebeest, in the Serengeti, at a certain signal, they start migrating. It looks like something that you cannot stop. No, but I'm not really that desperate. I do think, by the way, this situation can still be fixed. It's going to be very difficult. Mm. Cyril Ramaphosa does want to do good. He is facing formidable obstacles, some of them internal to himself, others just the ANC not really taking a firm position against corruption and risk a split, if that's what it would take, rather than manage a unity of the corrupt and uncorrupt. It just doesn't, it's not going to work.
Do you think there's a core group of people still within the ANC who would have the moral backbone to cause a split?
To cause a split?
Or split from the ANC?
I think if they didn't split from the ANC, it would not be for reasons of principle. It would be based on whether they thought they would survive or not outside of the ANC, which is why they are killing the ANC while remaining inside. I'm sorry, I have to say, when Zuma says, "I'll never leave the ANC," and he has caused so much destruction to it, it's simply because he knows he wouldn't be able to survive. It's part propaganda, part the reality that the ANC still has a very strong... The ANC's constituency is very strong. Mm. To have won the 2019 elections by 57% is a hell of an achievement.
It's quite amazing.
In the face of what's has been going on in the past 5 years and more.
But how do you explain that? Because that's also something I kind of struggle to get my head around. I suppose at one level you can understand a lot of people voting for the ANC nationally was a vote for Cyril Ramaphosa, and the provincial vote was different. But still, I mean, there are still so many. I speak to people that still support Jacob Zuma.
Yeah. I wouldn't be able to explain why anybody would continue supporting Jacob Zuma. I mean, maybe the ethnic factor for some of the people who are not educated, not really informed about the truth as to what's going on. Some people, you're right, actually believe that Zuma is being tortured, being abused.
Well, that he was a force of progress for the country.
I don't think people with sufficient understanding really believe that. I think people brings in, I mean, politics brings into its fold people who can be very articulate in stating things, but who really have no depth of understanding as to what's going on. Zuma has been extremely destructive to the economy, to social cohesion, to relations among people, to just about everything, apart from dyed-in-the-wool relatives and supporters who have benefited from the corruption that he made possible to exist. I was in KZN on the weekend, and I attended a meeting of the recently elected provincial legislators. And I was really very impressed. Oh, people may have some... Let me say this. I don't think in the room where there were 80 people or so, you would count 5% who would be regarded as diehard Zuma people. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The contributions from the floor, while not everybody embraced Cyril Ramaphosa, very few people actually said Jacob Zuma is right. The demonstrations that you see staged here, people passed from KZN, somebody provides money for that, and it's not the most credible people, let's face it, who stand behind Zuma. This, who is this guy with the MKMVA? The white...
Afrikaans.
Yes, that's right. He's,
His name slips my mind.
Carl Niehaus. I mean, really, if he offered to assist me, I would, try to ask him not to come close to me, because you really don't want to be associated with people like that. And so are many others who are right now supporting Zuma.
But there still is a sense that the NEC, even the top six, is still kind of split.
The top six is split because the ANC has been factionalized. When you get a person like Ace Magashule being elected by a majority of delegates to the position of Secretary General, you must know that the ANC branches have been contaminated. What better statement? This is a person who on two occasions failed to get delegates to participate at conference because of splits in his disagreements in his own. He arrived in Nazareth without the right to vote because a court had said that his structure had been inappropriately elected. You have a person whose association with the Guptas was not a secret, very well known. How could the majority of ANC branches think this is a person who should be there? The only explanation is that these are people whose votes are bought. So until what we talked about a little earlier, that you change the electoral process, the system of electing ANC people. You'll always have these things. And you can change it. You can put in place more stringent conditions for admittance into this thing and audit that. There is no need to rush for the 1 million members that the ANC seems to be proud of. You know, we did very well. We've recruited. A lot of that is chaff. And at any rate, you know, at its highest popularity level, ANC was voted in by 11 million people or so. Not 1 million. They would have voted 500,000, 200,000 quality people into government. Mm. So the issue is important quality instead of...
quality instead of quantity.
Instead of quantity, absolutely. Mm.
We need to, to end up. I mean, I could sit here for days. There are a couple of things we haven't had a chance to talk about, unfortunately. But I just want to get a sense from you now. Then, what do you see? What are your hopes and what are your expectations from the ANC in particular, given your history with the organization, from your early fighting days with Chris Hani to where we are today? I mean, you've called on people to vote for the ANC. You have that loyalty to the organization. What now next for the ANC?
Yeah, just to also put my call earlier this year into some kind of perspective. Actually, what I said, I did.
I'm not trying to trick you with that.
I did ask people to vote for the ANC. Two reasons. One reason. And the reason was, let me rephrase this. In asking people to vote for the ANC, I said I'm appealing to them as a South African, not as an ANC person. I said I'm talking to you more as a South African than as an ANC person. I can see the waste that has happened as a result of the corruption in the ANC. I'm fully cognizant of that, but I still ask as a South African that you vote for them. Why? Because when I looked at the state of the opposition, I just thought the ANC, with all its warts, and there are many warts, would still be better than, for the economy anyway, in the short term, than any of the others in combination or singly. For starters, the DA, a party that after 25 years still had more than 60% of the white people representing it in parliament. How serious is it about becoming South African, you know? Then you had the EFF. People who behave like thugs, racists, and all of that. And coalitions work in many countries. In fact, many countries cannot rule without coalitions. But here in South Africa, it's a coalition of what? What's the, you know, maybe some right-wing parties could coalesce on their right-wingness. But to get the DA or the ANC and the EFF, quite frankly, if the EFF believes that you can take land and put people anywhere where there is a vacant piece of land, that is not what the ANC is about. So given our situation, circa May 2019, I thought the ANC would be the best of the bad, the least bad of the group.
Best of a bad choice.
Best of a bad choice, yes, absolutely. And I really hoped also, I did hope, that having obtained a majority, Cyril Ramaphosa would have enough people to rally the forces and really overcome the bad apples that still remained, or convert them, because a lot of the people were not with Zuma because they thought he had some better ideological position. It had to do with either being afraid that if they criticized him, they would lose their jobs, or they were part of the feeding in the trough of those who were feeding. So it was on that basis. So I think the question that you really are asking is, what's the future looking like? It's my heart says it can and should be worked on, should be improved. This country is just too important for us and for everybody who lives on it, in it, to be allowed to collapse. And the potential to do that, if people put their minds to it, there's still a chance. But it's extremely difficult. Given a set of reasons, I think some of them are tactical reasons. I think we could handle this crisis differently than we're handling it now. I sometimes think that if the president decided to prick the bubble, you'd be amazed at how much nothingness would remain. Once our criminal justice system start to function, now that we have the Sean Abrahams out of the way, once the police are led by people who are ethical, and I think some of them are coming in, a lot of the thuggery, the criminality, which includes people who are in politics, will really start to be addressed very, very sharply. There are people who are in political leadership who should be in jail if the criminal justice system was working. Mm. And it's not for the ANC to put them in jail. It's for the criminal justice system to find out where the money is that was taken on your watch. Or, in fact, if you want to be very honest, in some of the situations, abetted by yourself, you know. So it's a foolish person who would say, no, it will be okay in 5 years. But there is a potential to do that. A lot of hard work needs to be done. I think some of us continue at this stage to run around, address people. It looks forlorn. It looks like a hope that is lost. But I think it should be done.
Mavusa, thanks. I admire your commitment, and I thank you for your service to this nation.
Well, thank you very, very much. I'm with many others who are doing a lot more than I am. This is not modest. It's just a fact. The fact that there are many people who are trying to make this thing work must give us hope that it will work.
Thanks again. Yeah, that's quite a story. He has been there and done that, I suppose we can say quite safely. I think we sometimes forget the courage of those who went into exile, particularly in those early days, to sort of start a liberation movement from scratch. I'm just full respect for him and his ilk. But you can hear the frustration, disappointment in his voice. I think it's quite sobering to hear from somebody so historically entwined with the ANC, who's totally committed to the ongoing fight for freedom and the upliftment of the poor, saying that for all intents and purposes, we stand on the brink of, or our democracy stands on the brink of destruction unless we unite and defend the sacrifices of the past. Quite something. Voices from SA is hosted on Audio Boom. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts. Please leave a comment or a rating. You can also subscribe via Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.